Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, top 10 legal battles, the Kraftwerk sample case. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
I don't need to say hello because you could just take me saying hello from a previous edition of Setlist and slot it in here. And that would be relevant to what we're here to talk about.
Sample
me saying hello there on a previous edition and slot it in here. And we would immediately be off to a relevant beginning.
If I do that, though, I'm going to cut out you saying this.
Yeah.
And then put in your hello.
That'll be a bit lost.
And it might, I mean, we'd know. Be fun for us, but I don't, it would just be you saying hello and that's just normal.
I bet most of our listeners would be like, I'm pretty sure that's the hello there from that last edition of Setlist. I reckon that's what would happen.
Hello, Chris.
Hello.
This is another of our special editions looking at some of our favourite music industry legal disputes of all time. This time we are going to talk about the lengthy legal battle launched by Kraftwerk, which asked the important question, can a 2-second sample possibly constitute copyright infringement?
Yes, this is the Setlist special where we talk all about the ins and outs of what copyright says about sampling, and in particular sampling tiny little bits of somebody else's track and putting it into another track. The copyright disputes over sampling are interesting. I guess it's kind of like the plagiarism case, it's like the blurred lines case. One of the reasons why it's interesting is most copyright infringement stories that we report on are the tech sector or the TV industry or the media industry battling with the music industry, whereas sample cases like plagiarism cases, it's where one bit of the music industry falls out with another bit of the music industry.
And that's fun.
And that's always fun. I remember years ago, in the sort of late 2000s, I think, being invited to do a panel on copyright and piracy as part of a thing called British Black Music Month in London. And it's late 2000s, so that is when the whole file-sharing thing was still a big talking point in the music industry, and Napster had been put out of business, and Grokster had been put out of business. I think Kazaa had probably been finally silenced, and everyone was using LimeWire. And I was used to going to events talking about copyright infringement, talking about piracy. And if you want to know what I was planning on talking about, there are several special editions of Setlist in the archive where we talk about that. But what was interesting with this panel that I went to was they quite quickly went to questions from the audience, and it became very apparent very quickly that the audience didn't want to talk about file sharing and piracy and all of that. What they were really interested in was what copyright law says about sampling. And it was an interesting audience because you had a few old timers whose background, they were musicians who had recorded soul or jazz and music like that. And then you had a bunch of sort of young hip-hop producers making sample-heavy music. And you've got a real tension going in the room, because the young producers were saying it should be easier to sample, we should be able to sample whatever we like, we're taking somebody's music and we're reinventing it, it's our creativity. Why does copyright keep getting in the way of sampling? Why are you saying that my sample is copyright infringement? And then there was one older musician in particular, and it was great having him in the room, who was standing up saying, how dare you take my music? That's my track. I should be able to stop you from ruining my track by putting it into your track. And a real good debate was going. And it was like, yeah, well, I have not come here this evening to talk about the copyright implications of sampling. But you know what? It's much more interesting than what I thought I was going to be talking about. And so this edition of Setlist, we're looking at one particularly we talk a lot about long drawn out cases on Setlist. This was a really long drawn out case about the ins and outs of what copyright law says about sampling, but we're going to name check some other cases as well as we go. In order to try and answer that question you asked at the very start, which is, if I take a 2-second snippet from somebody else's track and put it in my track, is that copyright infringement?
And in order to start answering that question, I guess we should start by separating out what are the things in a recording that you could sample that could then be subject to some sort of lawsuit. I.e. what are the copyrights in a recording?
Yeah, it's time to make a distinction between the song copyright and the recording copyright.
Yeah.
It's an important distinction to make because copyright law does say that in order for something to enjoy copyright protection, there has to be a certain amount of substance to whatever it is that the copyright is protecting. And this comes up in music cases quite a lot because, therefore, in order for copyright to protect a piece of music, so a musical composition, there has to be a certain amount of substance But then the law doesn't say what that means. So it's clearly a certain number of notes, a certain number of beats have to be in there to say the copyright kicks in. I mean, the same would apply to lyrics. So the example I give in our copyright seminars is, and I hope I'm not now going to infringe copyright in quoting these lyrics, there's definitely a critical analysis educational exception playing here. But if we take the famous lyrics to John Lennon's Imagine, Imagine there's no heaven, it's easy if you try.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I would say that lyric in its totality, that's enough substance for just that lyric on its own to be protected by copyright. There are enough words at play to say, okay, that lyric just on its own is protected by copyright. But the phrase, it's easy if you try,
yeah,
clearly that can't be protected by copyright. It would be insane to suggest that because John Lennon wrote It's Easy If You Try as a line in a song, he and his estate now control all usage of that phrase. That would be nonsense.
Yes.
And so because copyright law says there has to be a certain amount of substance for the copyright to kick in, it wouldn't kick in on that phrase alone. But I would argue that if you stick it alongside Imagine There's No Heaven, It's Easy If You Try, then that is enough substance to be protected by copyright. So that would be a lyrics scenario. The same is true when it comes to musical notes and to rhythm and to beats. There has to be a certain amount of substance for the copyright to kick in. So therefore, when it comes to the song copyright, if I take two beats from your track and I put them into my track, it would be very easy to argue, well, those two beats alone can't possibly be protected by copyright because there's only two beats. So therefore, that's not a case of copyright infringement on the song side. If I took a big chunk of your music and put it into my song, then there could be grounds on the song side too. But if it's just a tiny little snippet, which in the cases we're going to talk about today, they are tiny little snippets, then there can't possibly be a case under the song copyright. But the question is, what about the recording? Because remember, in a track, you've got two different copyrights, song copyright and the recording copyright. We're saying that you're not infringing the song copyright. But if you take 2 seconds of a recording, on the recording side, could we say that there's enough substance in that tiny little snippet for the copyright to kick in, so therefore the sample constitutes copyright infringement? So I guess most of the cases that we're interested in here, that's the question they're asking. They're saying, okay, on the song side, almost certainly no copyright, but what about the recording?
Yeah, so most of the cases of this type have happened in the US, not least because they're just more litigious in the US. Because obviously hip-hop originated in the US, and obviously that's traditionally a very sample-based genre. And I mean, the history of sampling litigations very much sit alongside the history of hip-hop, pretty much back to the beginning.
Yeah, as soon as that genre started to explode and become commercially successful, always the way, isn't it? When people are infringing copyright but not making any money, often nobody really cares, nobody does anything. But as soon as hip-hop started to become a lucrative art form, then you started to have artists and particularly labels who owned the recordings that were being sampled in those early hip-hop hits saying, well, in some cases, the hip-hop labels had done deals with the other labels, but in many cases they hadn't. And yes, that's when this question which we're here to ask today, what is the copyright implications of sampling incredibly small little snippets of other people's recordings? That was when that question started to be asked actually in the courtroom.
So there have been many cases asking this question in the US and just sample-based cases in general. But in terms of the question we're asking, the precedent was really set by a 2006 ruling in a case involving Funkadelic and NWA.
Funkadelic being the sampled act, NWA being the samplers.
Yes, NWA on their 1990 track, 100 Miles and Running.
Yeah, so although this is, relatively speaking, quite a recent case, it relates to quite an old track.
Yes, so yeah, it was a 2006 ruling, but the track's from 1990 and it was sampling Funkadelic's 1975 track, Get Off Your Ass and Jam. It sampled 2 seconds, basically a guitar chord being played. That was what it took from the recording. And I mean, I think this sort of thing happens more often than you'd think. Obviously, people think of sampling as like you take a vocal hook and you turn it into the chorus of your track. But I think quite frequently, certainly if you've got limited means, you're in the studio and you either can't play a guitar or you don't get the sound that you want, you could just lift one guitar chord being played, maybe change the pitch, maybe stretch it out, use it in a different way. And then that bit of your track's made. And you're not taking it to use the original track per se. You're just using it to get the sound you want.
Yeah, you're not trying to borrow the hook or the vibe or anything from the original track. It's just a quick way of getting the sound that you want. You're cutting a corner, basically. And as you say, that is quite a common practice. well, not just in hip hop production, in lots of different sorts of music production. And certainly,
I can think of two tracks off the top of my head that have done that, and no one has ever sued anyone. I'll just stop there.
These possibly being tracks in with which you were had some involvement.
No.
Couldn't possibly comment on that. And certainly in the early days of hip hop, but even today, particularly with how many bedroom producers there now are playing around in garage band and then sticking their music up on
SoundCloud.
Well,
the classic thing is taking drum breaks, just, you know, little bits of drumming and turning that into a drum track. It's not necessarily, I mean, it became a culture more than just a corner cutting, but it's, you know, you've got whole genres built on it. But it's not trying to recreate someone's track, it's just taking that to build something else on top of.
But my point is, in the early days of hip hop, and even today, when you've got bedroom producers making music and sticking it up online, many of the people who are sampling in this way don't even realise that they are potentially infringing copyright. They're not even asking the question that we're asking today, because I think a lot of people are like, well, that's a tiny, I mean, it's a second of a track. If I had a guitar and a guitar player and a studio, I could easily recreate it. But I'm just using that to save some time. And surely such a tiny, tiny, tiny slice of a recording, that can't be copyright infringement. So I think in many cases, certainly back in the day and to a certain extent still, people are doing this. They're sampling tiny little bits of recordings. And as you say, most of these, not only do they not get licensed, we wouldn't even know. I mean, it's quite often people are in the studio or they're at home on their laptop, they're playing around. And if you said to them at the end, when they delivered you the track, yeah, what have you sampled on this track? They'd be like, I don't know. I just played around and I got some music together. But yeah, what this Funkadelic NWA case set was, once all of this went legal, it was not initially a foregone conclusion that these tiny, tiny little snippets of tracks were definitely protected by copyright. It was pretty uncontentious to say there isn't a case when it comes to the song copyright, for the reason we've already explained. But even on the recording side, it was not a foregone conclusion that we were going to say this tiny, tiny little snippet is copyright infringement, which is why the ruling in this case was interesting.
Yes, because actually it went through various processes. There was a point where it was ruled in NWA's favour to say they hadn't infringed copyright. But the precedent was set with a later appeals court ruling that, yes, they had infringed Funkadelic's copyright by taking this two-second sample.
So this whole thing sometimes used to be communicated with the line, how many beats do you have to sample before the copyright kicks in? And basically the conclusion of this was, well, one is almost enough. So any slicing of a recording, that slice is going to be protected by copyright. It needs to be licensed. And if it isn't licensed, it's copyright infringement. Although, has to be said, while that is a significant ruling in this wider debate over in the US, where many of the sample cases are fought in the courts, it has to be said, the American courts have not been completely consistent on this. So, for example, in 2012, there was a ruling, again on a track that had been released considerably earlier. So this was a sample that appeared in Madonna's hit Vogue, which it turned out, we learned, years after that track had been a hit, it actually had a tiny, tiny little sample from a 1970s recording called Love Break. And so this lawsuit began when the company that owned the copyright in this 1970s track realised that a tiny little snippet had been used in Vogue.
Well, there was this company called VMG who basically, they bought up a load of copyrights and then they used some technology to analyse tracks and work out if anything had been lifted. So they were dealing very much in these small samples.
And that's what made this case very interesting. Yes, you could say, well, why had it taken so long for this case to come to court? Quite often in cases like this, actually, the track was released sometime before any court hearing takes place. But the reason why this case had not come to court earlier, yeah, it was because they'd got some newfangled audio ID, content ID type technology that they were running tracks through, that they were able to isolate the sample. So the sample was so slight and so out of context from the original piece that no one had noticed that it was in there.
It was referred to in the legal claim as a single horn stab.
And without this technology that this company had developed, no one had ever noticed that it was in there. However, if we're saying that the precedent has been set, that when it comes to the recording side, not the song side, the recording side, however slight the sample may be, doesn't matter if it's just one beat, that is still protected by copyright, there's still a case for infringement. In this case, we had a different ruling. What I would probably say, to an extent, was a common sense ruling in that you basically got the impression what the judge was saying in ruling against the owners of this 1970s track in favour of Madonna and her producer partner and the people behind Vogue was, if we have to wait 20 years, because by coincidence, Vogue was also released in 1990.
Yeah.
Nicely, we're connecting these stories together. If we have to wait 20 years for someone to invent a bit of technology that can identify that a sample has appeared in the track, then we should probably say that that sample is not protected by copyright and there is not a case for copyright infringement. So two very interesting rulings in the American courts, reaching ultimately, in a way, different conclusions to the question, how small does a sample have to be for copyright to come into play?
Yeah, and the judge in the case did note that in the Madonna case. She said that her ruling on the Vogue sample didn't set a new precedent versus the NWA case because the issue was that the sample was so hard to hear and there were too many ambiguities as to whether appropriation had or hadn't taken place. Then it wasn't the size of the sample that mattered, it was how distinct it was, or I don't know, something along those lines.
Yeah, so I guess what she's trying to do there, because judges don't like to be seen to be breaking the precedent of previous judges, is she saying, oh, well, there was an extra criteria that we were employing here. We weren't talking about how slight the sample was and whether that was relevant. We were talking about how distinct it was.
Yes, you could tell that the NWA sample had been taken from the Funkadelic track, is what she was saying, and in this case, you couldn't.
So applying an extra rule in ascertaining whether a copyright kicks in and whether there is a case for infringement. But as this is a British podcast.
A good European podcast.
A good European podcast. The reason why we are focusing on what is almost certainly the biggest sample case on this side of the Atlantic with regards Kraftwerk is because although we have all of these cases that have happened in America, maybe there's some precedents, even though it's a little bit confusing because we've had what certainly feel like they were conflicting judgments, even if the judge was insisting that they're not. What about the law on this side of the Atlantic? And that's why the Kraftwerk case, although it is a German case, is interesting to us here in the UK because it ultimately centred on some European law and what European law says about copyright. And although by the time you hear this podcast, the UK will not properly be a member of the European Union anymore, at the point that this case was going through the motions, the judgment had relevant on UK copyright law because ultimately it swung on what European law said about how much substance there needs to be for copyright to kick in and therefore whether or not a tiny, tiny, tiny little sample could constitute copyright infringement.
So this case started in the early 2000s over another track released, I think, don't think in 1990, but in the 1990s. So this case began in the early 2000s when Kraftwerk's Ralph Hutter sued rapper Moses Pelham and his co-songwriter on this track, Martin Haas, over a track they had released in the 1990s. Called Nur Mir, which also featured rapper Sabrina Settler. And it used a tiny little sample of Kraftwerk's track Metal on Metal, which it put on a loop. It was basically two bangs on some metal.
So as we said, this was a German dispute that spent many years bouncing around the German courts. It was accepted that Pelham definitely had sampled this track. Because I suppose when you sue someone for sampling your recording, the first thing you have to prove is that they actually have before we get into any copyright conversations.
Yeah, so that bit wasn't in dispute.
So the whole thing very quickly got back into our discussion of, well, if you sample a really small snippet of somebody else's recording, can that small snippet on its own be protected by copyright? Is this copyright infringement? And then we had a number of judgments in the German courts. It worked its way up the hierarchy of the German courts. And the initial ruling in 2012 actually found in favour of Kraftwerk because we knew that they had definitely sampled Metal on Metal. And they said that even though it was a really small snippet, there was copyright infringement under German copyright law. And in a discussion around that judgment, the court sort of went with the argument that it would have been really easy for Moses Pelham and his collaborators to recreate this sound. Because remember, we're not saying there's a copyright actually in the rhythm, in the beat, just in the recording. So it would have been really easy for them to recreate the sound. They were just being lazy.
Yeah, I mean, Kraftwerk's legal team went so far as to bring in a bit of metal and a sampler and do it themselves to show how easy it would have been.
And I suppose the reason why that was important in the context of German law is the debate was beginning, and as the case worked its way up the hierarchy of the courts, this became an even bigger part of the debate around whether or not by suggesting that copyright could protect a tiny little snippet of a recording, And therefore, whoever owned the copyright in that tiny snippet of a recording could now control the use of that snippet and therefore stop other people from using it. So not just in the context of they used it without license and that's copyright infringement. Had Pelham and his team gone for a license, Kraftwerk in theory could have said no. And we get into this whole debate of, well, by saying that a tiny little snippet is protected by copyright, therefore the copyright owner can control that, is that allowing copyright law to now breach the artistic freedom, the creative rights, the freedom of expression of the people who seek to sample? And I suppose that is why the "no, they were just cutting a corner" point was really important, because what Kraftwerk were saying, bearing in mind that, as I say, what's interesting about sample cases is these are artists versus artists, and artists don't really want to instigate a precedent in copyright law which could then sort of hit them in terms of infringing their artistic freedom. So yeah, what the Kraftwerk side were basically saying was, this is not a case of us breaching this guy's artistic freedom, his freedom of expression, because if he really wanted that sound in his song, then he could just have created it himself. So therefore,
and here's a bit of metal to prove it.
And here's a bit of metal to prove it. So therefore, by taking a slice out of our song, basically he was just cutting corners, he was just being lazy. So it is copyright infringement, and we shouldn't have to worry that by enforcing that copyright, we're impinging on his artistic freedom. So in that 2012 ruling, the court found in favour of Kraftwerk, but then when it worked its way up the court hierarchy, this idea of freedom of expression and artistic freedom became a bigger part of the conversation, so that people started to question that 2012 ruling.
Yeah, 4 years later, the German Constitutional Court overturned the 2012 judgment, reckoning that the lower court hadn't properly considered Pelham's artistic freedom. That higher court reckoned that the negative impact on Kraftwerk caused by the uncleared sample probably wasn't sufficient to outweigh Pelham's artistic rights, saying that if that sample was deemed copyright infringement, then that would practically exclude the creation of pieces of music in a particular style.
Now, I suppose if this had been an American case, you could have presented a similar argument under American copyright law by employing the good old fair use argument in saying that taking tiny samples should be protected by the slightly ambiguous concept of fair use under American copyright law, although that hasn't generally worked in the sample cases in the US. But, you know, a different concept, but a related concept. This idea of the artist's freedom of expression, and are we allowing copyright to breach the artistic freedom of the other people? And as we say, yes, at the lower court, they decided, actually, no, we don't have to worry about that. This is copyright infringement. At the higher court, they said, actually, we're much more concerned about the impact of saying that copyright does apply here on this thing called artistic freedom. And it was at this point that the whole thing moved up a level, because all the copyright systems in all the countries of the European Union are linked together through European law, which has sought to harmonise copyright across Europe. It has to be said, with mixed success. But the copyright systems around Europe are linked through European law, and it was decided that this question of, is a tiny little sample protected by copyright, should we be concerned about freedom of expression if we say that it is? We wanted to get clarity on what European copyright law said about that. So a bunch of questions were sent from the German court up to the European Courts of Justice.
Yeah, and that's why the Advocate General of the European Courts of Justice ended up musing on this issue in 2018. His conclusion on this sort of thing isn't actually binding, but does tend to be quite influential in this sort of instance, and indeed was in this case.
Yeah, the Advocate General is not the judge who makes the final decision, but in some cases he's presented with all the information and all the facts, and he has a really good think about things and reads up on some precedent from the European courts and then publishes his judgment. And similar things happen to that in some cases in the US as well, where they'll get a sort of, in essence, a more junior judge to invest more time into weighing up the pros and cons of an issue. They then publish an opinion. The judges back in the court could tear that opinion up and say, we disagree, but that doesn't happen very often. And as you say, it did not happen in this case. The judges subsequently pretty much endorsed everything that the Advocate General said in his paper.
That paper made a very specific distinction about this case being centred on the recording rights and not the song rights.
Yes, like this podcast, he was very keen to stress that there are song rights and there are recording rights, that this case was not about song rights. And what he was basically saying was, had this case been about song rights, it would have been pretty clear cut that there wasn't a case.
Yeah.
Because there was not enough substance in that tiny little sample when it comes to notes and rhythm to the musical work for there to be a case for copyright infringement. But this is not a song rights case, it's a recording rights case. And so he basically was considering the question that we've already posed, which is, well, with a recording, can we also say there's a point at which there's not enough substance for infringement to occur? Or almost by definition, the minute you take a slice of somebody else's recording, is that copyright infringement, however short and nominal the sample may be? So that was what he was considering in detail. And basically his conclusion was, if you take a slice of somebody's recording, it really doesn't matter how slight it is. By definition, you are making a copy, you are making an adaptation, and therefore that is protected by copyright, and doing that without permission, that is copyright infringement.
So he said, sampling generally involves the direct and permanent reproduction by digital means in any digital form of a portion or sample of a phonogram. It therefore seems to be quite clear that that act amounts to an infringement of the rights of the producers of the phonogram in question to authorise or prohibit such a reproduction made without their permission.
And as for the argument that maybe there isn't enough substance in the sample for the copyright to kick in, he said no. That's not the case. Remember, this is a recording, and he said a recording. Actually, he said a phonogram. Old-fashioned words.
Phonograms were fun to say, isn't it?
Is it?
Yeah.
Phonogram is not an intellectual creation consisting of a composition of elements such as words, sounds, colours, etc. A phonogram is a fixation of sounds which is protected not by virtue of the arrangement of those sounds, but rather on account of the fixation itself. Consequently, he continued, although in the case of other creative works, like, for example, a song, he didn't say that, but I'm just embellishing on what he said, whereas with these other creative works, it is possible to distinguish the elements of the work which may in themselves not be protected, such as the words, the sounds, the colours, such a distinction is not possible in the case of a phonogram.
He also discussed the differences between European and US law, and although, as we've said, the big American case on sampling kind of agreed with what he said, he did note that there's been a fair amount of inconsistency in rulings on this matter. But he then insisted that when it comes to European law, the US rulings on this don't really matter.
Yeah, so while there may have been a little bit of variation in different rulings going on in the US, this is European law, European copyright law, US copyright law, two different things. And he also acknowledged, I mean, from a UK perspective, this isn't strictly speaking true, because actually in many ways, UK copyright law is more like American copyright law than it is the copyright systems elsewhere in Europe. But most continental European copyright systems do treat sound recordings and songs, so the two sets of music rights, differently. They sort of originate in different elements of the law, and they are routinely treated in different ways. Whereas in the UK and the US, we tend to put sound recording copyrights more closely to song copyrights. But he was sort of saying, yeah, under a traditional European copyright system, we're used to treating recordings and songs differently. So whatever's happened in the American courtroom, it doesn't matter. It's a different jurisdiction. This, in his opinion, is how it should be treated under European law, which is when it comes to a recording, however slight the sample may be, you still need permission. If you don't get permission, that is definitely copyright infringement, was his opinion, which, as we've said, was then endorsed by the judges of the European Court of Justice as well.
As well as the classic question of how long or short does a sample need to be before it becomes copyright infringement, he also considered the other matter that came up in the previous German court rulings of artistic freedom.
Yes, and he gave a few thoughts to that issue, which, as you say, had come up in the German hearings, where the Pelham side were basically saying, if we interpret copyright law in this way and we say that taking slight snippets of recordings, that's copyright infringement if you don't get permission, that would have a negative impact on the creative freedom of the artist. So the Advocate General considered that as well. And basically, in the same way that he said what happens in US courts is irrelevant, he was basically saying all talk about creative freedoms are not relevant in this case either.
Yeah, he said artists must be particularly aware of the limits and restrictions that life imposes on creative freedom where they concern the rights and fundamental freedoms of others. In particular, their right to property, including intellectual property. In such cases, the balancing of different rights and interests is a particularly complex exercise, and there is rarely a one-size-fits-all solution. That balancing exercise must, in a democratic society, be undertaken first of all by the legislature, which embodies the general interest.
But, he added, and this was the key point, that when it comes to what European law says about these things, the requirement of obtaining a license for sampling, i.e. the requirement that he has just said is definitely there, That requirement does not restrict, in his opinion, the freedom of the arts to a degree that extends beyond normal markets constraints, especially since those new works often generate significant revenue for their authors and producers.
6 months later, the European Court of Justice endorsed all of that in their final ruling on this matter. The court said in a statement, "Phonogram producers have the exclusive right to authorise or prohibit reproduction in whole or in part of their phonograms. Consequently, the reproduction by a user of a sound sample, even if very short, taken from a phonogram must, in principle, be regarded as a reproduction in part of that phonogram, so that such a reproduction falls within the exclusive right granted to the phonogram producer." There's a lot of phonogram in that quote.
Yeah, they really like the word phonogram. They should have put recording at least once to get a little bit of balance in their use of words. But they like being precise in these legal proclamations. So I suppose once they've picked a word, they've got to stick with it. However, we should note that in the final ruling in the European Courts of Justice, they did add an extra paragraph, which, although the Advocate General had gone to great lengths to state that American law was irrelevant in all of this, this extra paragraph that was added kind of is the same as what was said in that Madonna case back in the US. And you'll remember how we explained that when they decided that the sample in Vogue did not infringe copyright, the judge was keen to distinguish that from the earlier NWA ruling on the basis that the sample was unidentifiable to the human ear. And that's why they were reaching a different conclusion in the Madonna case versus the NWA case. Well, actually, in the ECJ ruling, there was a paragraph that was in essence saying the same thing, which is although they were adamant that if you take a tiny, tiny slice of somebody else's recording and then use it without permission, that's copyright infringement, they then did say that if you were to take it and use it in such a way that nobody could recognise it was there, then in that case, it probably wouldn't be copyright infringement. So having tried to reject the variables in American cases, they then kind of endorsed that variable in the final ruling. So in their words, they said, where a user in exercising the freedom of the arts takes a sound sample from a phonogram in order to embody it in a modified form unrecognisable to the ear in another phonogram, that is not a reproduction. So there you go. Some clarity, almost.
As close as I think we're ever going to get to clarity on this sort of thing.
On sampling in Europe, which, although we're keen to distinguish between European copyright law and US copyright law, in some ways a similar conclusion across these cases, which is recordings are different to songs. However small, however slight the sample is, because you're taking it from a recording, substance doesn't really matter in the way that it would if you were taking notes or rhythm or whatever. That is reproduction. It's copying. You need a license. If you don't have a license, it's infringement. Oh, except if you take it and you do something with it, either that it's so slight and low in the mix that you can't really hear it, or maybe you warp it, you extend it, you mess around with it, then possibly in that scenario, you are fine, is kind of the precedent that we have on sampling. I suppose this is why, in the modern age, there is quite a good business in companies that take sounds that people like from other songs, but which are too slight to enjoy copyright protection in the song or the musical work, and then they re-record them and then sell them to people to put in their songs. Because obviously, song sample isn't protected by copyright. We know that. The recording probably is, but only if you use the recording, not if you recreate it. So in these judgments, the entire industry of recreating little snippets of music so that you can use samples without having to license the original recording has evolved.
But in the era of bedroom producers and everyone making music, there are a lot of people out there who aren't paying that much attention to what the European Courts of Justice are saying on this. I don't really understand the ins and outs of what's legal and what isn't when it comes to sampling.
Which is why I suspect if you go certainly onto the YouTubes and SoundClouds of this world, and I imagine quite a lot of them end up on the Spotify's and Apple Musics as well, and you're listening to those, homemade bedroom productions. I mean, actually, there are certain very established producers who seem to do this all the time. They're nabbing stuff off the internet. They don't really pay attention to what they're nabbing. Maybe some of it they are taking from libraries that have been set up to allow you to use them in your music, and that's fine. But they're also grabbing things off the web. They're taking little slices and they're not really thinking about it. And then they've created something and they upload it to SoundCloud. They upload it to their distributor. In some cases, they're big name producers who hand them over to a major record company. Everyone forgets the sample is in there. I suppose, I mean, bearing in mind what happened with that Madonna case, it is worth remembering that there is now software out there, or even if it doesn't exist now, it probably will in the next decade, which might spot that little sample And I suppose, just in case it turns out you've written a hit, it's worth being aware. And indeed, through CMU DIY and the workshops we run, this is one of the reasons why we go out around the country explaining the basics of music copyright to young music makers.
Because you have had some unusual interpretations of what can be done.
Yes, the loaded questions that we get asked at our CMU DIY workshops, where there'll be something along the lines of, it's okay, isn't it, if... And the answer is always no. But you know that the question is, this is what I did last week, last month. This is where my main...
It's quite often... It's all right if I just take someone's instrumental and sing over that.
We have had that.
Because it's my own lyrics.
And surely it's okay if we just take a couple of beats from an existing song. Surely that's okay, isn't it? And of course, while there are still a few ambiguities around the edges, as we've discussed, the basic rule is when you're taking the recording, no, it's not okay. Yes, you can recreate it. That's almost certainly fine. It's a whole different debate as to how many notes, how many beats do there need to be for it to be infringement. That's more in the sort of blurred lines case territory. But when it comes to recordings, it's fine to recreate. But yeah, if you take a slice of anything and it's not from a library which is providing you those noises, those beats with that in mind, then there may be some copyright problems down the line. Basically, everybody making music at home should have to listen to this edition of Setlist first, I think, is the conclusion.
Well, they could sample this edition of Setlist and put it in a track.
They could.
I mean, get permission from us.
Obviously, otherwise we will sue you for copyright infringement and then make a Setlist special all about that lawsuit, which would be a bit meta.
It would, but I think we should do that.
But could be entertaining.
Anyway, that is all we've got time for on this special edition of Setlist. If you've got any feedback on this week's episode, do email us at setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. You can also track us down on social media if you like. We are Setlist Pod all over the place. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Malt and Chris Cook. It's produced by Archan Mohile. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at unique facilities, Setlist is an Unlimited production.